Riders of the storm, into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, and actor out alone. Riders on the storm, there's a killer on the road, his brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday, let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet family will die. Killer on the road, yeah.
Guard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Indeed. Good morning, everybody. We're talking about things quantum at the moment with Professor Brian Green. In the quantum world, we're told, the rules are not the same. The rules of physics simply are not the same in the quantum world. Therefore, I wonder what's going to happen when we develop a quantum computer. My understanding is that we're well on the way, or at least on the way, toward that possibility. When you go to the great Google on the quantum computer, I wonder what kind of answers you might get to some of life's more difficult questions. What a thought. I'm certainly at the very edge of what I understand about any of this myself, but I have heard talk of quantum computers taking quantum technology and applying it to a computer, and I started wondering, Professor, if such a computer could be constructed, what kind of insights it might provide. Might it actually go elsewhere to retrieve answers that we can't, with the physics of the world we understand, retrieve?
In a sense, the answer is yes. Again, it goes back to those probabilities that we were talking about before. Because in essence, what a quantum computer does, it harnesses those probabilities in the following sense. If there's like a 10% chance an electron can be here and a 42% chance it can be over there, well, in essence, maybe you can do two calculations at the same time, one using the location of the electron to your left and the other using the location of the electron to your right. And a quantum computer, in essence, makes use of this whole spectrum of possibilities to do a whole spectrum of calculations simultaneously. Huh. And thereby it can do much more in the same period of time than a conventional computer could do.
Any ideas how much?
Oh, it can be enormously more fast. It can be exponentially fast compared to today's computers. It can therefore do calculations that we would, for instance, have to wait thousands or millions of years for a conventional computer could do, and in principle it could do those quite quickly.
Are we talking about something that is a more powerful computational capability than the human brain?
Well, it presumably operates according to an architecture that's rather different from the one in which the human brain operates according to, although there's much about the brain that we still don't know.
Right.
But if you do sort of view the brain as akin to today's computers, where you have processes happening one after the other after the other, this quantum computer would take a different tack. It would try to do many things simultaneously. It would have, in essence, it would do the most parallel type of computing that you could imagine. Now, again, this is all hypothetical.
Oh, sure.
There's a great deal of theory that has been worked out that would underlie a hypothetical quantum computer. But put putting these ideas into practice is pretty tough, and people have been working on it for many years and have only, you know, they've made rudimentary progress, but we're pretty far away from a real full-scale quantum computer.
If we had one, Professor, you know, we talk a lot about artificial intelligence. Couldn't the speed of the computational capability mean that we might run smack into a quantum, what we would think of as a, or might think of as almost a quantum life form itself?
Sure. One of the obstacles toward having an artificial intelligence that we could view as intelligent. We usually don't view computers as intelligent. We view them as interesting tools.
So far.
But if you did have a computer that was fast enough, able to retrieve information quickly enough and able to manipulate that information with dexterity that you might have with a quantum computer, then I certainly could imagine that you'd be able to create something that would be akin to an intelligent form.
That opens up so many interesting avenues of thought, in the sense that then we are the creators. We actually have manipulated and then created an intelligent life form.
Yes. Again, I would hasten to say that we do that all the time. Of course, we reproduce. So we do create intelligent life forms all the time. The difference here would be we wouldn't be doing it biologically. We'd be doing it mechanically.
Well, when we do it biologically, we get a very close copy, you know, capability, IQ-wise, and all the rest. If we had a quantum computer and ran into life because of the speed of the processing, it could conceivably be so far beyond us so quickly that it could end up controlling us instead of the other way around.
Yeah, there have certainly been science fiction stories, you know, along those lines, even back, you know, in the early 1900s, you know, far... seeing writers imagined a time when we created a machine that was smarter than we are and was able to ultimately control us. You can't imagine this. I don't consider it very likely, but certainly this is something that is within the realm of possibility, however unlikely it is.
Do you think that when science is approaching that precipice, that it will be something that it will consider as a conceivable danger to pushing the on button?
You know, I doubt it. I think it's the kind of thing that one bears in mind as a remote possibility, but in all of this research, you go step by step by step.
Yes.
And I think that the worry that you raise really comes from imagining a leap from the rudimentary understanding of computers and quantum computers today to tomorrow having a full-scale one in our possession. Mm-hmm. In reality, we'll get to that full-scale one if we ever make it, step by step by step over many, many, many years. And in that process, we'll begin to understand how to address these issues along the way. So I don't think it's a real worry and certainly won't stem progress in any way.
Or could it be that when we finally do get the quantum computer, it's the one that comes up with the elusive theory of all?
Well, that would be nice. That would be fantastic. You know, I don't really care where the answer comes from. You know, we are searching for the deep laws of the universe, and if our gray matter inside our heads is not up to the challenge of figuring out the fundamental laws of physics, maybe the gray matter inside our head can create something that is up to the task. And that would be a perfectly acceptable way to find the deep laws of physics from my point of view.
Professor, you said if we were to discover the theory of everything, that it wouldn't have any immediate impact on our lives necessarily. I understand that. But what can you imagine it might ultimately mean in practical application?
Well, let me give you an analogy, because I can't give you a complete answer by any means. But imagine we were having this conversation and the year was, say, 1925.
All right.
And people were just now discovering quantum physics. And you said to me, okay, you've got this understanding of molecules and atoms. What's it good for in practical terms? And I think I probably would have said to you back then...
Not much.
Not much at all. And yet today, the year 2005, 80 years later, quantum physics is the reason why we have cell phones. It's the reason why we have personal computers. It's the reason why we have lasers. It's the reason why we have all manner of medical technology that allows us to do fantastic things in preserving and extending human life. So quantum physics has a tremendous impact on everyday life. This is something which, in fact, I've been surprised at how many people don't realize this. A significant fraction of our gross national product comes from quantum physics, because quantum physics underlies the integrated circuit which is inside of every computer. So is it just a long way of saying that 80 years have elapsed and something which we could never have predicted in 1925, that quantum physics would have an incredible impact on our everyday lives, has come to pass?
Well, so, can you look ahead and guess at any practical application that another, 50 years of understanding might bring?
Well, 50 years, I think, is a pretty short period of time when it comes to applying some of the ideas that we are developing in our search for unified theories and string theories. But I can imagine, 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now,
okay,
maybe our understanding of the laws of physics will allow us to manipulate things in ways that today we can hardly imagine. I mean, that's really the progression of science. You go from complete confusion to partial understanding to complete understanding, and then ultimately you use that understanding to manipulate the environment.
Would you say things like time and gravity?
Yes, exactly. That's the kind of thing I have in mind. So maybe 500 or 1,000 years from now, we will learn how to use gravity to manipulate space and time, to warp space in ways that we do volitionally. We can't do that today. Maybe we can also warp and control time in a volitional manner in the ways that we were discussing earlier. Maybe we will execute some kind of travel to the future in the manner that we were discussing earlier.
And so, you see this as a possibility in 500 to 1,000 years?
Say it again.
In 500 to 1,000 years, you said?
It's hard. We don't have crystal balls in physics that allow us to predict, the rate of progress.
Right.
But I don't consider it to be absurd to imagine that 1,000 years from now we'll be able to manipulate time in ways that today we would consider, part of science fiction.
Well, people suggest then, no matter when it might be in the future, then, of course, today we can reasonably ask, well, then where are the time travelers, the manipulators, where are they?
Why haven't they come back?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's one, that I, all of this is mind-bending, tantalizing stuff, but this issue in particular I do take up in my latest book because it is one that I think there is an answer to, and the answer goes like this. When you look at the proposals for time machines, which, again, hypothetical, probably can't be done, you probably can't travel to the past, but let's just assume that you can.
Okay.
All of the proposals have the property that you can never travel to a moment before the first one of these machines was built.
Oh.
And that means that perhaps the reason why we haven't seen these travelers from the future is because we haven't yet built that first time machine. And if we build that first time machine in the year 2500, then the travelers will be able to travel back to that moment. But our moment, when we haven't yet built that first machine, will not be accessible to them.
Why?
Well, this is really a function of the particular time machine proposals that people have come up with. So it's not a general rule that you can't travel to any moment in the past according to the laws of physics. Maybe we will be able to prove that one day. We haven't yet. But when you do look at the machines that people have proposed, they all seem to share this property. Now, I can't give you an explanation for why the laws of physics would have it be that way. No, this is really a function of the proposal that people have put forward. And that seems to be a common feature of these proposals, and therefore it's a potential answer to your question.
Well, you don't see any airplanes flying in the air until the day we invented the flight.
That's right.
So I guess in that sense, yes. But the very nature of a time machine would be to travel in the past, not just the past where one has been invented, but...
But here's a rough way, very loose way of saying it. Imagine you did have this machine and you used it to travel to the past, and you travel to the moment before the first time machine was built.
Right.
Well, by definition, that would be kind of paradoxical because you would have then taken that machine to a moment before that machine was built.
Got you. So it can't exist.
So it can't exist. So that's a very rough way of saying it, but that's the kind of reasoning that would go into this explanation for why people from the future haven't yet come back to visit us, simply because the machine doesn't yet exist in our time, and therefore they can't travel to this moment.
That's certainly the best I've heard yet. No question about it. Fascinating. Then manipulation of gravity would perhaps allow near-light speed, or who knows, even faster than. Do you, as a physicist, believe that faster than light travel is conceivable?
No, I don't think faster than light travel is possible. Again, this comes from Einstein's work in relativity, which seems to be how the world works. However, you can do something which is perhaps the next best thing. Imagine you want to go from one point in the universe to another, and you're able to kind of bend space so that the distance between the two points is less than what it would have ordinarily have been. Imagine, just to give you an image in your mind, imagine you have a piece of paper, and you put an X in one corner, the upper right-hand corner, and you put another X in the lower left-hand corner. Mm-hmm. How do you go from one X to the other? Well, you go across the sheet of paper. That's the long way.
Or
imagine instead that you bend the page so the upper left-hand corner and the lower right-hand corner, they come close together.
Then you just walk across.
Just walk across. And if you could do that in the universe, well,
yes,
in essence, you would go from one point to another far more quickly than you would have thought, based upon the speed limit, that nothing goes faster than the speed of light, because you found a shortcut.
Essentially, traveling faster than the speed of light.
In essence.
Yes. Although what you've done is you've bent space and time, I guess, up against each other, like that sheet of paper.
Yep.
Well, all right, now this really walks out on a plank, I know, but we have these incredible craft that are sighted all the time that do things that don't agree with current physics, these UFO sightings we have, some of which are quite spectacular, and not all are explained by even the best scientists. And these craft do things that seem to defy our understanding of gravity and physics and all the rest of it. And so is it not just barely possible that we are being observed by somebody 1,000, 2,000 or 3,000 years or more in our ahead of us, who have traveled here in the manner you just described?
Well, I think you probably recall my views from our previous conversations that I'm 100% skeptical of any of these claims of UFOs being anything beyond things that we can explain in terrestrial terms using the known laws of physics.
Yes.
But, you know, you could say to me, well, can you prove that? No, I can't prove that. And therefore, do I have to admit the possibility that there are strange things that go on? Yeah, I do. I do admit that. I am an open-minded person, an open-minded physicist in general, so I don't rule out with 100% certainty that there are strange things that we have yet to explain. But I need to emphasize that I've never seen any data, I've never seen any example that really convinced me that there are things beyond what we can explain using our known laws of physics and using known terrestrial objects, you know, weather satellites and things of that sort.
Yes, but, you know, looking at the fact that there are, now we know, planets probably revolving around more suns than not. We know there's a lot of suns out there, endless in the sky, with all these planets revolving about them. The likelihood, probability even, of life would be, I guess, numerically pretty high.
Well, that's a different question.
I mean, and that some of that life would have evolved perhaps far thousands of years ahead of us. Well, certainly possible.
Sure. Yeah, that's a different question. You know, is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? And I would say that as we understand the universe more and more, to me it seems at a gut level ever more likely, you know, largely for the reason that you're saying. We're beginning to recognize that planetary systems are pretty common.
Right.
And therefore, you could at least imagine that on some fraction of those planetary systems, some form of life exists, and perhaps it has evolved, and perhaps it has evolved to an intelligence beyond ours. I do consider this a real possibility. But if you then go further and say, have we been visited, and is there data from these sightings that you mentioned that suggest we have been visited, that's where at least my comfort level drops.
Well, I understand that dropping of the comfort level, and I'm even with you there. But there are a lot of inexplicable things that don't agree with physics as we understand them. Things move in the sky in ways that gravity and, you know, a being of our sort certainly just couldn't do it.
Well, again, I don't see any data supporting that statement. I've never been presented with any convincing
evidence. One of these days, perhaps something will pass above your head in a manner that will cause you to do more than just scratch it. They really are out there. These things really are out there. And I guess I was just asking, you kind of built the case in a way yourself by saying that we'll work toward a manipulation of forces like gravity.
Sure.
And then I'm thinking, well, sure, intelligent life probably is out there, and you're with me to that point. But then I suggest, well, why would it not be reasonable that a life force like that might decide to visit here?
Sure. I don't consider it unreasonable at all. I just have never seen any evidence for it in the data that people commonly use to support the idea that we have been visited. So that's really where I deviate from the kind of reasoning that you're suggesting. But I'm with you all the way toward the possibility that there is intelligent life, and that intelligent life might have gone beyond our capabilities.
All right.
In fact, I have to say I love that idea. I'd love to meet these individuals. I'd like to ask them what the details of physics are.
That might be arranged, Professor. Hold tight.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Want to know more about all of this? And my guest, Brian Green, Professor Brian Green, he's got two books, The Elegant Universe and the Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality, exactly the kinds of things we're talking about right now. And hopefully written so somebody who's, well, like myself, can understand what we're reading. We'll ask about all of that in a moment. Again, Professor Brian Green, a couple of books out there, Professor. Are they written so that the average person can have a hope of grasping what you've written about?
Yeah, that's exactly the whole point of these books. You know, the research that underlies everything that we're talking about, of course, is done in the language of mathematics that, you know, only people that are highly trained can follow. The point of my books is to translate these cutting-edge ideas into ordinary, everyday language, you know, using illustrations, using analogies, using stories, so that you can get a grasp on some of these cutting-edge ideas without having to go to graduate school in math or physics.
Wonderful. If somebody were going to begin and go get a book today, which one would you recommend?
Well, I would say actually, strange enough, go for the second one, The Fabric of the Cosmos, the more recent one, because it actually has a level of difficulty that's much more even keeled. The Elegant Universe starts out in a way that is pretty accessible, but it builds and it builds and it gets kind of steep toward the end. And also, The Fabric of the Cosmos talks more about the ideas that we've been speaking about tonight. The ideas of quantum entanglement, that's a central part of the book. These ideas about what is space, what is time, which features are real, which features are illusory. All of that is what The Fabric of the Cosmos is about.
All right. Probably available on Amazon.com,
yes,
all the usual places, right?
Sure.
Okay. Well, then, folks, I recommend you do that. Back to intelligent life for a moment. No, I can't introduce you to an alien, but I, you know, a number of very reputable scientists, in fact, now, Professor, even governments are beginning to say, look, there is something to all of this, or at least there is enough of something to all of this to justify a real in-depth scientific investigation of what's going on around us. But I guess you would try and make the case, wouldn't you, that there's really not.
Well, I would try to make the case that, yes, it's always worthwhile to explore things that are mysterious or things that have yet to be understood. And that's great. That's what science is all about. What I would suggest, though, is that every time that we have studied one of these supposed sightings, there seems to be an explanation that is far less mysterious than anybody would have thought at the beginning, at least those who were pounding the idea that this perhaps was some visitor from a faraway place. So I'm not trying to say that we can't be visited, that we haven't been visited. I'm simply saying that there's no evidence so far that I can point to that convinces me that we have. But again, I emphasize, I want us to be visited. I would love for us to have communication with other beings. I think that would open up a whole another universe of thought and possibility. So I'm all for it. But I'm not for hype. And I think there's a lot of hype surrounding the possibility that we have been so far visited.
Okay. Let's examine the likelihood of the temperament of any visitors that we might have. If, for example, I wonder which school you're from. If we were to be visited by a life form that is thousands of years ahead of us, technically, which is a fair supposition, I think, just by virtue of the fact that they get here, Is it a foregone conclusion that they're going to be friendly little creatures with our best interests at heart? In other words, another, I don't know, several thousand years of evolution, is that going to make up, would that make us better people?
Well, of course, I haven't the slightest idea, so now we're entering realms that are kind of conjectural, but I guess the answer that I would give you is more a testament to a fundamental optimism that I have as opposed to any scientific judgment. And I do think that as we evolve and as we understand the universe better, we are better beings in the sense that we recognize the impact of what we do and we hopefully try to only have positive impact. So my optimistic outlook suggests to me that these beings would not be hostile. But, of course, again, we're entering a realm of complete conjecture.
Oh, we absolutely are. And the way you've just set it up is really perfect. Assuming that they're benign, at the very least, if not better, then what is called the prime directive in Star Trek might well apply, and that would be to observe, for example, but not to intervene in any potentially harmful way.
But of course, in Star Trek, there was constant intervention. But that's a
well, you're right. But there is the rule, even though they break it all the time. There is that rule.
And I can certainly imagine that that would be the case, and I could imagine that one day in the far future, when we do reach the stars ourselves, we probably will have some sort of guidelines and how to interact should we find other beings in place as well. So it's quite natural.
And certainly not to tamper with civilizations that could be totally turned on their ear. I mean, if you went to a civilization and gave them atomic weapons too early, they could easily destroy themselves. I mean, all sorts of terrible things could.
Right.
So one could imagine that a race thousands of years ahead of us might be observing us without direct interaction. Again, making the case for these strange things that we see flying. At any rate, I had to try, so there you are. Listen, string theory, this is yet another really, really hard thing for people to digest. String theories, the suggestion there are more than just three dimensions that we are able to observe, many other dimensions, maybe 11, maybe more. Is there any way you can lay this out for us in a way that we can understand?
Well, sure. I think the actual basic idea of string theory is among the easier ideas in modern physics to grasp. I recognize that there are features of the theory that perhaps we can come to extra dimensions that are hard to understand. But the basic idea of string theory is simply this. We have learned, as we discussed earlier over the last 100 years, that matter stuff is made up of atoms at the smallest of scales. But we've also learned through subsequent studies that those little atoms are themselves made up of smaller particles. You've got a central blob called the nucleus, which has neutrons and protons inside of it. You've got little electrons flying around the nucleus, sort of like little planets around a central sun. That's sort of the image that we always draw on pieces of paper.
That's right.
Now, we've also learned that the neutrons and protons have particles inside of them. Those are the quarks. You actually mentioned them earlier on in the discussion. Now, that is where the conventional ideas stop. Quarks and electrons are little tiny dots, and there's nothing finer inside of them. That's where string theory comes along and suggests that there may be something finer. There may be something else inside of these particles. And string theory says that if you were to magnify an electron big enough, magnify a quark big enough, you would see that there is something finer, and the little something finer is a tiny filament. It kind of looks like a little string. It's a little filament of energy, and it's vibrating. It's vibrating at different frequencies. And the different vibrations correspond to the different particles. I mean, you know, when you go to a violin and you pluck one of the strings, it vibrates in one pattern or another, producing different musical notes.
Right.
For these little strings in string theory, when they vibrate in different patterns, they don't produce different musical notes. Instead, they produce the different particles. So an electron is simply a string vibrating in one pattern. A quark would be a string vibrating in a different pattern.
Now, so that the public understands, it is my understanding, we have not yet actually seen a quark, have we?
We have not directly seen a quark, and we believe we understand why. It is one of the features of the force that acts on quarks that they can never be in isolation. They're always in groups of two or groups of three, which we then see as the proton, for example. A proton is a group of three quarks, and we believe that you can never pry one out of a proton and view it in isolation, at least not in the current conditions of our universe.
So, therefore, we have not seen a quark by itself.
No, but what we do is this. We can fire particles at a proton, and the way those particles are deflected from the proton, we get very convincing indirect evidence that the particles are being scattered off of three little entities sitting inside the proton. I mean, for instance, if you gave me a peach and you wanted me to figure out what's inside of the peach, but without actually pulling off the outside to see the pit itself, an alternative way to recognize that there's a pit inside the peach would be I can take a little BB gun and I can fire it at the peach. And based on how my little pellets bounce off of the peach, I could learn that there's a little hard nugget inside. And that's how we learned that there are three little nuggets inside a proton that we call quarks.
And this is why you scientists are so anxious for these big so-called colliders, like the one they didn't build in Texas, I think?
Yeah, exactly right, because that's how we determine how things are made of. It sounds kind of crude, but we basically do a version of that peach experiment. We take particles and we slam them together at incredibly high speeds, and based upon how they scatter off each other and the debris that's created, we learn about the fundamental makeup of matter. And the bigger your accelerator, the more quickly you can make the particles move, the more energetic you can make them, and therefore the more refined your experiments become. And that's why people had suggested building a very big atom smasher in Texas.
Right.
That was partially completed, but then shut down in the early 90s.
How big a mistake was that not to build that?
Well, I think it was a huge mistake. I mean, I understand the political reality that it's hard to spend $10 billion on a science experiment, but, you know, after all, I think it's the most noble thing in the world to try to understand what we are and where we came from and what the laws of physics are. And when you compare the amount of money that that machine would have cost versus how much we spend, for instance, on unnecessary wars, not to get overly political here, It does seem hard to imagine that we would spend that kind of money in one context, but far less in another, where we would have perhaps learned something very deep about the universe.
Were there, layman's question again, I always wondered if in the use of the collider, had we built it, there were potentially any dangerous aspects to doing that?
Well, you can imagine that there might be, and that's why some studies were undertaken just to rule out the unlikely possibility that there might be something dangerous, and people did calculations that established beyond any doubt that there was nothing dangerous.
What was the worry?
Well, there are a number of worries that you could at least imagine. For instance, maybe you create in your collision a state of matter that kind of wants to spread out and change the environment around it, so it spreads more and more and more, like, I guess, Ice Nine in Kurt Vonnegut's book, you know, that kind
yes.
of entity. Mm-hmm. And we call this a phase transition. The universe is in one phase right now, but just as liquid water can turn into solid ice if you change the temperature, there was a little tiny worry that maybe the universe, as we know, it would change to a different phase in much the way that liquid goes to solid, if we created an impetus that might be instigated through one of these collisions. But people did calculations and basically ruled out that possibility. So there's no danger in these machines at all.
But there would have been a great deal of potential knowledge.
Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely. We perhaps could have learned really about some deep questions that are still mysterious. Now, it's not to say that everything ground to a halt when that machine was not built. Other machines have been built. So we in America have a powerful machine in Illinois. Fermilab in Batavia, Illinois has our most powerful atom smasher on our soil. And right now, an international collaboration is building a new atom smasher, a new accelerator in Geneva, Switzerland, at a laboratory called CERN. And it's a machine that's called the Large Hadron Collider.
Right.
And by 2007 or 2008, that machine should be ready. It is not going to be as powerful as the one that we were trying to build in Texas, but nevertheless, it will be more powerful than any in existence, and we hope to learn a lot from it.
I worry that the United States, in so many areas of science, this being one of them, another being stem cell research and some other areas, I don't know, we've just either fallen behind because we're unwilling to spend the money, or fallen behind because of moral principles of some sort or another, and other countries seem to be racing forward, and I wonder if we're at a kind of a junction point where we're about to get past.
Well, I think it's a real worry, because to remain part of the world conversation on these cutting-edge ideas of physics, you have to dedicate resources to it. And what we have found in the last few years is that resources, rather than being added, have been subtracted, have been cut. Funding has been cut for a lot of cutting-edge research.
Right.
And some research, as you note, has been stymied based upon political, so-called moral and religious conviction that we shouldn't be entering that realm.
That's right.
And this is very unfortunate, because we are a species of curious beings, and we need to follow our lead, follow our hunches, follow our intuition to unravel great mysteries. One mystery, the one that we as physicists are working on, is the mystery of creation, how the universe began. But other mysteries in biology and medicine can be answered by stem cell research. And to not carry out that research is very, very unfortunate, very, very wrong, very misguided.
To find, and that is that the ultimate goal of physics, to find out how it all happened? That is the ultimate goal?
If you ask different scientists, I think they're motivated by their pet question that they want to have answered in their lifetime. I certainly have always been most fired up by the question of creation, you know, why is there a universe at all? It's sort of the biggest question that you can imagine answering. But other scientists are fired up by, you know, trying to understand what happens inside a black hole. Or other scientists are trying to figure out how galaxies form. Other scientists are really trying to figure out what are the fundamental constituents of matter, the ones for which there are no finer entities inside. All of these are deep questions. And others are guided by some of the questions that we discussed earlier, trying to figure out what is the true nature of time? Does time have a beginning? What is time? What is space? Is space an entity or just an idea? These are the kinds of questions that fire up physicists around the world.
Where are we with dark matter? I'm hearing so much about dark matter now that it's not truly the emptiness that we all envision, but rather it's filled with this substance called dark matter.
Yeah, well, this is one of the wonderful discoveries in the last, you know, 30 years that has only received more and more support in the intervening decades, that, you know, when you look out at a night sky, darkness you normally would associate with emptiness.
That's
it's dark
right.
because there's nothing there.
Right.
But we have learned that the darkness is filled with stuff. And the reason we know that is because if the only stuff that's out there was the stuff that we could see, that stuff that we can see does not exert enough gravity to account for the motions of objects that we can see in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, there has to be more stuff out there to exert more gravity than the luminous material can exert. So we've learned that there has to be stuff out there that doesn't give off light. And if it doesn't give off light, it's dark. And if it's dark, we don't see it directly. So for a long time, we've known that there is dark stuff out there. We have been trying to figure out what the dark stuff is made of. And we have learned through theoretical studies, bound up with experimental observations, that the dark stuff can't be the ordinary stuff that you and I are made of. The dark stuff cannot be atoms, neutrons, and protons. No, it has to be made of some kind of exotic material, and we are trying to figure out what that exotic stuff is.
We sent out some early satellites, actually designed to leave our immediate area. I've read some articles recently suggesting that these satellites are now beginning to gather speed in a way that cannot be accounted for. And I wonder if there's dark matter pushing them or something.
Yeah, you talk about like these pioneer anomalies.
That's right, yes.
I don't know much about that, so I don't know how seriously those anomalies are taken or to what extent people have found explanations for it. I would doubt that dark matter has anything to do with it, simply because while a great amount of the total mass of the universe is in this dark stuff, the amount of gravity that it exerts in a local environment is pretty small. It's really only on the large scales of the universe, scales of galaxies and clusters of galaxies, that the dark stuff really exerts a force that we can measure. So
I suspect that's
not the answer.
All right, hold it right there. Well, something is pushing those spacecraft, apparently at a faster and faster speed. Makes you wonder. About all of this, really. My guest is Professor Brian Greene. I'm Art Bell.